you how you can get from the 10-dimensional string theory to a 4-dimensional theory. But what I would like to do first is to run you once through the entire lecture, through our little crash course, so that you do have a better picture, an overview of what is what we have been discussing, what are the connections between different topics, and ask me questions. So the main idea is just to get right now the idea, not concrete calculations, but the main idea of what we would like to do, so and what are the connections. So in week number one, Freddy Kashatsu appears, and he tells you about the bosonic string. So he writes down an action for the bosonic string. And let me write down the complete action, which is going to be useful later on. So he tells us that there's a string action, a bosonic string action. Then, as I say, I would like to write down the entire action, so the most general action that you can write down. So in general, there's going to be the tachyon that you already saw up here in the spectrum. Then there is another term in the action. So people usually, many people don't write the entire thing, so they just write to show how the action looks like. They just write down the term of the metric. But in principle, you do have more terms. And there I can illustrate already something that I pointed out several times by now. So here we do have an antisymmetric tensor. And last thing is there's a curvature term. Which contains the dilaton. And I had pointed it out several times already that what we see in this case is, for the case of a string, what we see is that we can define a two-index, since the theory has a two-index object and it's a string. So on the worksheet of a string, the two-index object lives on the work volume of a string. So if I do have a three-index object, tensor fields that appear in other theories, so I'm going to write down very precisely later on the action for the membrane, just so you see how a tensor field lives on the membrane and what a tensor field living on the brain means. So I'm going to write it down later. So, but what you see here is that an antisymmetric tensor, a two-index object, lives on the two-dimensional world volume. Similarly, you can write down, as I'm going to do later, so for brains, you can write down this action has a straightforward generalization. And on those world volumes, you can define tensor fields. So which means each time you see a tensor field, you know this theory has a particular type of brain. What else did he do? So then he looked for you at the equations of motion of this theory. And he tells you, OK, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to send x mu to x mu, just so you know, it's the same thing as in Landau-Lipschitz. So he sends x mu to x mu plus delta x mu, and he concludes that the equations of motion are only satisfied if he makes sure that the boundary terms vanish. So let me write down, let me call this t so that I can follow, so the string tangent t. And he looks at the boundary terms, tells you, well, what I do have is a boundary term that I need to make sure it vanishes. So the prime here denotes the derivative with respect to sigma. And I'm taking sigma, so let me first write this here. I'm taking sigma to take values between 0 and pi, just for convenience. So let me put it down here. So the sigma I'm taking just for convenience to be between 0 and pi. Well, and what he discussed is, well, there are two cases how I can make this boundary term vanish. I can either take a closed string where, so there are two cases for the closed string. So all I do is identify the fields at the two boundaries. So at the let me just write it. So what we do is we identify the field at the coordinate x or sigma with a field at a coordinate sigma plus pi. So what I know is that both expressions, so at sigma equal to pi, sigma equal to 0, I'm going to have the same expression, which means the boundary term vanishes. Yes?
Why did you write down the other fields? Because when we originally, like, we originally saw the tachyon as a mode that you got after quantizing, just the original bosonic string action. So why is it now part of the action that it came from?
Well, that is that's the most general thing you can, in principle, write down. But it's a good point. So people usually just write down this term here. But when you later on do the spectrum of the theory, so you know that you can write down. So you know that you get, as you said, there are tachyons in the spectrum. There are antisymmetric tensor fields, and you can, in principle, so write down the action which contains also these fields already. So, but so
what? Thing is consistent with what?
It has to be a renormalizable action. So the most general renormalizable action that you can think about.
Okay, so nothing to do with the file symmetries or the different morphisms?
Oh, well, of course, you have to make sure, okay, that's first a point. Yeah, you have
we
to
want both of those symmetries to stay.
Yep, so theory has to be, it has to be consistent with the symmetries, of course, and it has to be the most generally renormalizable. Though the thing with the renormalizable, so if you later on go for p-brains, things are no longer renormalizable, and you are actually not considering p-brains as fundamental objects, rather as solutions to the equations, like you were pointing out. So there are solutions to the equations of motion that you and different types of tensors you get by looking at the spectrum of states. So, but here in principle, we can write down the action and incorporate them in the action. And so, what we have is a different type of boundary conditions. We can also have an open string. And in order to make this boundary term vanish, so what we can do is we can either say, well, these derivatives here at the ends are equal to 0, which means that we fix the momentum at the end. So we hold the momentum, so this sigma of x mu is equal to 0 for sigma equal to 0 and pi. So that's the momentum is fixed, which are called the Neumann boundary conditions. But you can also hold, make this x delta of x mu vanish at the end. So you can do the other case where delta of x mu is equal to 0 at sigma equal to 0 and pi. And in that case, so the boundary conditions are called Ramon boundary conditions. All you're doing is you're holding, so the x mu is equal to x0 mu, so it's a constant for sigma equal to 0, and it's a constant, let me call this pi mu, for sigma equal to pi. So you're holding both ends of the string fixed. Oh, sorry, I'm thinking ahead. Sorry, you're absolutely right. Seriously, boundary conditions, I don't know. That. Oops. Dirichlet boundary conditions. Thank you. Okay, so these are different type of boundary conditions. And once you know which type of boundary conditions you have, you can work out how the solutions to the equations of motion that solve these boundary conditions look like. So just as you know for the harmonic oscillator, where you get modes, you can in this case also look for the solutions to the equations of motion and make a mode expansion. Those mode expansions are going to be integers or half integer mode expansions, depending what type of boundary conditions you would like to have. So from here, you can look at the equations of motion and get the mode expansion. So once you do have the mode expansion, so you know very similarly as for the harmonic oscillator, where you know you have got raising and lowering operators, so you can do the same thing. You can construct here the spectrum. So you know that you do have a ground state. A ground state in the theory, which if you compute the mass of this ground state. So you conclude that the mass square, can compute the mass of the state. And what you see is that the mass square of the state is less than zero. In other words, it's a tachyon, something that kind of doesn't make sense. You can go ahead for the next. Let me still leave this action there. So if you look at the next level where you start acting on the ground state with raising operators or with some of the oscillators, so what you see is that you obtain, if you act, so oh, let me point out, I'm discussing the closed string because I'm putting two modes now. So for the closed string, so you may recall that you do have two different types of modes for the string. So ones that you called alpha, for which comes from left and right movers, ones that you called alpha tilde, acting on the vacuum. So you can compute for such a state, you can compute the mass, and the mass comes out to be zero. And this object is a two-index tensor, so let me call this omega ij. And this massless state, so in the supersymmetric case, this massless states are exactly the states that I was interested in when I was discussing low-energy effective actions, so the states that are incorporated in low-energy effective actions. So for this case here, for the bosonic theory, so what we know is that if you do have a two-index object, so a two-tensor, we can in general decompose such a two-tensor into what? We can decompose it into a part that is symmetric under the exchange of I and J. So, and this describes, so that's symmetric. So you may have heard this already in quantum mechanics, so symmetric here, which describes the graviton. So then there is a traceless part, which describes the dilaton. And then there is an antisymmetric part, which describes the antisymmetric tensor. So in this way, you can compute the massless states that you do have in the bosonic theory. One thing that is important and that probably hasn't been emphasized enough is that you see that in this action, there is an alpha prime in the action, which means that you can do, you can calculate, you can do a quantization of the theory, calculate, set up a perturbation theory of the in terms of this coupling constant, which is in front of the action. So there are two types of expansions. So this one is the alpha prime expansion. So in string theory, there are two types of expansions. So number one, we see perturbation expansion in string theory. So we see that there's a coupling constant alpha prime, so there's an alpha prime expansion. Oops. And what you see from the action, so you do the proper dimensional analysis, what you see is that alpha prime has got dimensions of length square, so dimensions of alpha prime is length square. And so, which means that alpha prime times the momentum square is dimensionless. So that's the dimensionless coupling constant in which you would like to do your perform your perturbation theory. Or in other words, alpha prime times the energy is the dimensionless coupling constant. And we had seen, so the reason why, so the alpha prime limit is called low energy limit, so alpha prime goes to zero, is called low energy. So is that, so what we actually are talking about is our the coupling constant alpha prime times E. So it's a energy, low energy limit of the entire string theory, so of entire corrections, is alpha prime goes to zero limit. But there is another parameter in which you can expand, namely when we do have a string. So there is a string worksheet. And you can take, so the alpha prime expansion makes sense for, just a second, so makes sense for a specific surface. So you can have, so in string theory, you can have different surfaces that describe the string worksheet. And the alpha prime expansion makes sense for each one of the surfaces. Yes, you had a question.
Yeah, so what is E over here?
What is E? Oh, the energy. Just imagine it's a dimensional analysis. Kinetic energy
so
is mv squared.
Squared, maybe?
No, I'm putting momentum squared, which is energy. Mv squared is kinetic energy.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah?
Okay.
So which means energy times alpha prime. Yes?
Then if you make it expansion to alpha prime e and you take alpha prime goes to zero, e could be arbitrary that. So why are you calling it limited expansion?
Okay, there's a different, so okay, I cheated a little bit in this way, so, but there's a different way of seeing it. If you give me just a moment, when I show you how concretely the beta functions of the theory look like, you will see that in the alpha prime goes to zero limit, you will get exactly Einstein's equation. So, but yeah, okay, it's true what you say. There was another question. Oh, same question, okay.
Yeah,
this energy has any units of energy squared?
Does the energy have units of energy squared?
What? Does the energy have energy from energy squared? Wait. Is it energy squared? Why is it energy squared?
Well, alpha prime is length squared, you said. So, and then you wrote alpha prime p squared. So I thought it would be energy squared, but if you think p is p squared, then.
Yeah, so that's how I was thinking.
E is e squared over m, so it should be
e
or e squared over m.
Okay, good. Okay, you are absolutely right.
Maybe it's square root of alpha?
Well, it doesn't matter. So they come together, so let me put here an e to the power whatever. And so e to the power whatever, and so, but. So the thing is that it's a dimensionless coupling constant, so here comes the homework. So figure out what the dimensionless coupling constant is in which we are expanding so that we know so what we mean when we talk about low energy limit. So what so point number two, so we do have a GS expansion, so we can take now different types of surfaces, and which is an expansion, so the expansion parameter of this is called the string coupling constant GS, which is related to the expectation value of the dilaton. And so different surfaces over which we are assuming here have different powers of the string. It's an expansion in different powers of the string coupling constant. And when, yes? Well, you can compute Feynman diagrams in perturbation.
So we're writing down doing a path integral then over this with this action?
Yes, when you compute scattering amplitudes, you take a path. It's like a path integral. Yeah, it's exactly. You can use a path integral formulation to compute graviton scattering amplitudes. Like
so when you say you're doing perturbation expansion, that's what you mean. You're doing.
Yes, yes. It's Feynman diagrams, so different scattering amplitudes, so you can evaluate at each order in perturbation theory, either in alpha prime or in GS. Good. More questions? Yes.
So when we're doing this path integral and we're summing over all string configurations?
Over all surfaces. Yes, over all different types of surfaces on which the string can move.
Okay, and like a ball and like, I don't know,
yes.
If you stretch it, are those two equivalent?
Topologically equivalent, so you can go, but that's a very good point. So you're asking now about moduli fields, so they are topologically equivalent, but the stretching and changing of the shapes and sizes, it's going to enter as one important point in string theory, which is called the moduli space problem, that if I have time, I'm going to address it. So yes, they're considered topologically equivalent, but different shapes and sizes are going to have an effect. But that's a very important point. More questions? Yes?
Is there should be a torsion exam?
You have to start another what?
Is there should be a torsion at the first of GS? The first of GS?
We're missing
Taurus.
Okay. Let's put a torsion between you. And so on. And when we talk about perturbative string theory, so what people did before 1995 is they computed string scattering amplitudes. They were working everything just in perturbation expansion in the GS, perturbation expansion in the alpha prime. So that's all what people knew. And when you do that, so what you see is that you arrive at the conclusion, okay, so there are five different string theories, perturbative string theories that are different in 10 dimensions. So before 1995, so there are five different string theories, which at that time seemed a little bit kind of odd because you would like to have a theory that describes all forces in nature having all forces in nature as a single theory. So that sounded kind of odd having five different string theories. So people knew about T-duality before 1995 because T-duality, which is a symmetry which inverts the radius. So it sends a theory with radius r to a theory with radius 1 over r. This is a symmetry that holds to at every order. So for every surface that you do up here, T-duality, you can check that T-duality is present. So it's a symmetry that holds perturbatively. So which is why even before 1995, people knew that if you take the type 2a theory on a circle with radius r, then it's equivalent to the type 2b theory on a circle of radius 1 over r. So T-duality is something people knew about. So the thing that people, after 1995, when people considered non-perturbative string theory, is effects in GS that go with 1 over GS. So a non-perturbative string theory is not here. So there's another symmetry. So let me say it that way. So there's another symmetry, which is S-duality, which inverts the coupling. So inverts the string coupling constant GS to 1 divided by GS. And so it's a non-perturbative duality. So, and the behavior of string theories under non-perturbative dualities, so it's something people started thinking about after 1995. So, recall that yesterday I was explaining, for example, we looked at the mass of a D0 brain in the type 2A theory. And what we saw is that the mass of the D0 brain in type 2A theory goes with 1 divided by the string coupling constant, which means that if I would like to go to the weak coupling limits, what I see is those D0 brains become very, very massive. So D0 brains are non-perturbative effects in type 2A theory. In other words, so their mass goes to infinite and perturbative in type 2A. So their mass becomes infinite when you go to the limit where GS goes to 0. And this happens to be the case for all D brains. So if you compute masses of D brains, so all of these are states where masses go with 1 divided by the string coupling constant, which means they are non-perturbative. So the statement we made yesterday is that the strong coupling limit of the type 2A theory is 11-dimensional supergravity. And we checked it by at the non-perturbative level by showing that the masses of the D0 brains can be explained as the masses of the Kaluza-Klein mode coming from the graviton. So that is what we mean when we talk about non-perturbative and perturbative string theories and the equivalence between them. So once you take non-perturbative symmetries into account, so then you can show that the five string theories that we wrote down in 10 dimensions, which, so let's paint again the picture. Let me just put it here. So the five theories that we wrote down in 10 dimensions are actually related to a web of string dualities. And I discussed yesterday one particular type of S-duality when we showed that the type 2B theory is invariant under an S-duality transformation. Yes?
So why is it that the S-duality transformation gives you an equivalent theory?
Why is it that?
That the S-duality transformation, sending GS to 1 over GS, why does that give you an equivalent theory?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't always give you an equivalent theory. So yesterday we described the type 2A theory, type 2B theory, and what we saw is that in the type 2B theory, so type 2B theory gives you, it's a theory that is self-dual under S-duality. So for type 2B, what we saw yesterday is that there is a symmetry in the type 2B theory where the action that we wrote down is invariant under a shift, so it's a more, even a more general symmetry, A tau plus B, C tau plus D. So it's invariant under a more general even SL2R transformation. And one of these transformations is the one, so where tau, recall that we called tau is the axial dilaton. And you see that the action is actually invariant under such a transformation. So so tau was the axial dilaton, so which is we had this phi c0 plus I times e to the minus phi. And so that's a symmetry. So if the theory is in, if the action is invariant under such a symmetry transformation, it means, so set for now the c0 equal to 0. So what you see is that it's invariant under a symmetry which sends tau to minus 1 over tau. So for particular values, so if you take A equal to 0, B equal to 1, C equal to minus 1, D equal to 0. So then you see particular case of that is the tau goes to minus 1 over tau. And we saw that under such a transformation, the type 2B theory is invariant. However, it's not always so that a theory is invariant under this transformation. So in fact, if you take the type 1 theory, which I didn't discuss how the action looks like, and you do such a transformation, you get the SO32 heterodic string. So it doesn't have to be always that way. It's the case for the type 2B theory. But good point. So that is what I wanted to say. Let me see what the next thing is that I would like to point out. OK, so now comes the important point where I would like to make another connection to the low energy effective action. So Freddy Cachazzo in his last lecture, so the Swift lecture, he discussed conformal field theory. And I'm not sure whether he told you how. So what we know is that we do have a well-tuned of a string. So we do have the conformal symmetry. So it's a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And he explained a little bit our conformal field theory. So, but what you can do is, if you would like to check that a theory is conformally invariant, so you can compute beta functions of this theory. So I'm not going to enter how they are defined or anything like that. But let me just point out that if you do have a conformally invariant theory, it means that the beta functions have to be equal to 0. And if you compute the beta functions for the theory that I just wrote down, so what you see is an amazing expression. So what you get is the following. Let me just write down maybe one of them. So what you see is from the beta functions of the two-dimensional conformal field theory, you're actually getting, so let me just finish here. Plus order alpha prime. So, and for conformal invariance, so this has to vanish. So what you get from here, so is exactly equations of motion of a 10-dimensional theory. So vanishing of a beta function of a 2-dimensional theory, whoops, gives you equations of motion. For I do have more beta functions there, but let me just write this one to illustrate. So you get equations of motion of a 10-dimensional theory. And when I talk about low energy effective action, what I'm writing down is an action that reproduces such equations of motion. So maybe that makes a better connection to the 10-dimensional formalism I was discussing earlier on. Yes?
So what are all these things?
What are all these things?
Yeah.
You mean the things that I do have here? These are fields of the theory. So this thing here, I should probably have said, so what it is H, so it's a 3-index object, which is the dB, well, it's a good question, thank you. So it's an H is equal to dB, so it's the field strength corresponding to the B field that I have at my QE. So that's the H that I'm introducing. This here is the Ricci 2 tensor, so which comes from the metric. Here I've got my dilaton, which is the one I had in my action there, and my tachyon. So there was another question as well. Yeah.
Yes, what's the exponent 6 from the
G for metric.
Okay.
Because you get, for each field, you get such an equation. So there's another one for the dilaton and so on. And I wrote just one of them. More questions? Yes?
So are these the beta functions arising from renormalization?
Exactly. And you can study how they are concretely defined, how beta functions are concretely defined, how to study on your own. But for me, it was just to illustrate the connection to the theory, to the 10-dimensional approach. So vanishing beta functions is conformal invariants. So then we get, so unless there are more questions about week one, I get to week two. So in week two, Catherine comes and says, I'm unhappy with what Federica Schatzo was saying because he has got a tachyon in his spectrum and the theory doesn't have fermions. So in nature, we do have fermions. So she says, what I would like to do is to incorporate fermions in his approach. Oh, I probably don't want to erase this one. So the first term, and let me just take now the first term in the action and not write down all the rest of the story. So week two is putting fermions into the action. And she started introducing you, so let me put it here. She started introducing you to the RNS formalism, which stands for Ramon, Nebo and Schwartz. And what she did is she added to this action, she added an action containing fermions. So she added another term containing fermions. And the spinner fields that I'm defining right now are two-dimensional worldsheet spinners. So which means it's a two, so these are 2D worldsheet spinners. They have two components, so each psi mu I'm writing down there has got two components. Let me call them psi plus and psi minus. So it's a fermion that lives on the worldsheet. So each of these fields, so this is a spinner field on the worldsheet. So what we see is there's an index mu that goes over space-time dimensions. So what I see is that X here is a bosonic field on the worldsheet, but it's a spinner field, it's a vector field in space-time. So X mu and psi mu, so both fields, X mu and psi mu, are vectors in space-time. While X is a boson on the worldsheet and psi is a spinner on the worldsheet. So on this theory, so each of these fields, X and psi, so depend on coordinates tau and sigma. Well, and you can write down the corresponding supersymmetry transformations. And so she did the same thing as Freddy. So what she did is she looked at the equations of motion for this theory, arrives again at the conclusion, my equations of motion are satisfied if the boundary term vanishes. So there's going to be a boundary term for the fermionic fields. That has to vanish, so sigma equal to 0 and sigma equal to pi. And again, so you can have different cases. So for the closed string, so the first one we discussed, so all we do is to identify the field at x with the field at sigma plus x. So we do have, let me call this sigma and tau plus minus psi plus minus sigma plus pi tau. So you simply identify. But you can have also open strings. So as we discussed before, for the case of open strings, and what you get there is two different types of boundary conditions for the fermions. So for the open string case, you see that the boundary term vanishes into cases you can take. So let me fix an overall normalization. So if this fixes just the overall sign of the expansion. So this is just convention, the one at one end. So this is convention to fix an overall sign. And now it depends how I identify my fields at the other end at sigma equal to pi. So depending on what I do at sigma equal to pi, I do have two types of boundary conditions. So let me put this. So the boundary term vanishes if I identify this with a plus sign. So which are called Ramon boundary conditions. Or if I put a minus sign in between, let me write it down one more time. Where they are called NS boundary conditions. And so, what we can do is to calculate how the solutions to the equations of motion look like that that satisfy these boundary conditions. And then, what's that question? Psi minus. Sorry. Yes, I meant the same thing. Thank you. Same thing, just with a minus sign. So boundary terms should vanish if I do that. So what we can do is to take boundary conditions into account and compute the solutions to the equations of motion that satisfy these boundary conditions. And then, from there you can construct your string spectrum. So one thing is not particularly clear is that space-time supersymmetry in this approach is not manifest. So you can, it's hard to kind of see offhand which fields will give you space-time fermions or which ones will give you space-time bosons. So supersymmetry, space-time supersymmetry in this approach is not manifest. Well, is it clear? Well, space-time supersymmetry you want to have because it has good, nice properties. So there are many things that become, number one, simpler if you do have supersymmetry in space-time theories. You can calculate more easily with them. supersymmetry explains some problems, like the hierarchy problem. So why is the mass of the Higgs so much smaller than the Planck mass? So supersymmetry is a good thing. Later on, you have to worry about, which you hopefully will find at the LHC. Later on, you have to think, how do we break supersymmetry at low energies? But having supersymmetry at high energies, it's a very useful thing to have. But it's, again, a good point, so to have or not to have supersymmetry. So again, so space-time supersymmetry is not manifest, so that there's a second formalism. So, and both formalisms are of the 1970s. So it's the Green-Schwarz formalism. So right now we are in the 1970s. And what they do, so what Green and Schwarz did in the 1970s, is to take into account, instead of worldsheet spinners, they took space-time spinners. So so they wrote down an action, which I think you do have a homework about this for a point particle. So it's a straightforward generalization of the point particle. And now the spinners that I'm going to introduce are space-time fermions. Space-time spinners, I mean. So now theta is a space-time spinner. So it's a 32-component space-time spinner. This index A that I do have here labels the number of supersymmetries. So A runs from 1 to whatever number you have. So labels supersymmetries.
An A bar.
And depending on how many thetas we do have in our theory, so we can have a theory with n equal to 1 supersymmetry where we have just one theta, or we can have a theory with type 2 supersymmetry where we do have more than one theta. So from there, so from the Green-Schwarz formalism, so one advantage of the Green-Schwarz formalism is, as I said, that space-time supersymmetry is manifest. If you compute the spectrum, you don't need to carry out GSO projection to see that the tachyon goes away in the theory. And the nice thing about this action is that it has a straightforward generalization. Also, if you take now p-brains into account, and as I say, I would like to show you how the action for the membrane looks like, so that we see how. Why don't I do this? So let me do this now. So let me show you how an action for a membrane looks like, so we can see how we can associate the different types of brains, different types of tensor fields. So the action for p-brains, so it's generally written down in this formalism. And let me just show you an example. So the action for the 11-dimensional membrane, so let me call this S3. So it's a three-dimensional object. So you see, it starts looking really very similar as what I had for the case of the string. Plus, so let me just write down the relevant bosonic terms. So that's an action, I think, that is known since the 70s, probably. So and here you do have this tensor field, so the direct coupling between this three-index tensor field to a three-dimensional surface. So you cannot define a tensor field on a two-dimensional surface because it would vanish. But in this case, So that's the relevant terms that I would like to show you. So what you see is that if you take, and you can do the same thing, if you take other higher dimensional extended objects, so if you do have a five grain, so you can, a five-dimensional extended surface, you can put an index, a tensor with five indices on it, and so on. So that's how you see that when you find in your spectrum different tensor fields, you know that your string theory is going to contain more than just a string, it's going to contain the extended brains. So string theory is nowadays not considered just a theory of strings, but it's a theory of strings plus all the brains that come with it. So all the types of tensor fields come associated with a particular type of brain, so it's the entire collection that you need to take into account. So then we get to week three, where, so Katrin showed you how to do the spectrum of this theory. I'm not sure how much she discussed about D-brains, so I'll check with her to see how much she discussed about D-brains, and I can summarize about D-brains a little bit tomorrow. So then we come to week number three. So right now we see what we discussed in perturbative string theory. So are there any more questions about the discussion on perturbative string theory? Okay. Yeah.
About a flat background in space-time.
It doesn't have to be flat.
So is this isn't necessarily a flat background here, for instance?
No. It doesn't have to be necessary. But I took the metric arbitrary.
So it gets more complicated if you try and use like a complicated space. Do you always start with picking a space-time metric?
Exactly, yeah.
Just trying to see how it works. So is that what you mean by perturbative, that you have a space-time metric and then the G's or whatever you find are actually fluctuations about that metric?
Exactly.
Okay.
Just the root string theory is, those five super string theory are first quantized theory.
Mm-hmm.
And so the set of duality make people think that it exists Marshall theory or M theory. But my question is, where string field theory stand in this picture?
Oh, that's like doing second quantization?
Yes.
So, but that I don't think that string field theory has right now solved any of the... So, well, you can understand vacuum quantization in string field theory, but string field theory is something that is really underdeveloped. And I think mainly because the formalism is really complicated. So, but it's like doing second quantization in string field theory, and right now not much has come out of it. So it's something that too few people are working on because it's a really hard formalism. So, but it's a good question. Yes?
And so for the dilaton action, why is there no alpha prime for that one? Not right here, but I mean in what we were saying before, the part of the action.
Oh, did it have a different order?
So there's no alpha prime because of the dimensions. You look at the dimensions of things, but then.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What is the significance of not having an alpha prime?
Yeah, good. He has it right. Yeah. If you do have derivatives, the derivatives come with dimensions of length or whatever, and then you need to compensate with alpha primes in it. Okay, mm-hmm. That was a very sharp observation. Good.
But what's the significance of not having an alpha prime? So when you do an alpha prime expansion, then
it's
1 over alpha prime.
Yeah, well, you can figure out what the orders in alpha prime are. If you look at the beta functions that I wrote down, so they were all in the same order in alpha prime. So I'm not sure in which step of the calculation the alpha prime comes out in the right place then, but look at the beta functions that I wrote down. I wrote them alpha prime to the order 0 plus things that come alpha prime to the proportional to alpha prime.
So it just works?
It works. So let me just... Yeah, so the so if I look at the beta function that I wrote down, so everything goes alpha prime to order zero, then I do have mixed orders in alpha prime. So the beta functions come out in a really nice alpha prime expansion. So so in the next, so week number three, so I started assuming what people, so what Catherine and Freddie discussed in week one and two, and what we started discussing is the equivalence of string theory at the non-perturbative level. So I started drawing the diagram of the five different string theories, perturbatively different string theories in 10 dimensions. And we discussed that the theories, the string theories that people thought were different in 10 dimensions, they are perturbatively different, are just not so different after all if you take string dualities, non-perturbative string dualities as well into account, and they are just different corners of one and the same theory, that is M theory. M theory, we discussed as a theory, we don't really know what M theory is. We know that its low energy limit is 11 dimensional supergravity. There was a proposal on how to define M theory in terms of D0 brains for transmatrix theory. So the theory has its trouble because you can only define matrix theory in theories that are, say, 11 dimensions. But compactifying matrix theory to discuss low dimensional theories brings some trouble with it. What we had seen is that I started discussing dualities and equivalences of string theories, and I started showing you that 11-dimensional supergravity is equivalent, so I can do a dimensional reduction of 11-dimensional supergravity and obtain type 2A string theory, type 2A supergravity. So what we saw is that 11-dimensional supergravity, if we compactify this on a circle, the circle of the radius of the circle was LS times GS. So what we obtain is type 2A supergravity. And again, so it's the supergravity, it's the theory that describes the massless states of type 2A string theory. And so from the low energy effective action, from the low energy effective action of M theory, I get type 2A supergravity. So there's a conjecture, so Witten made the conjecture, and there are arguments for the conjecture, that the strong coupling limit of the entire type 2A string theory is 11-dimensional supergravity, so there's a strong coupling limit. And the way we showed that there is an equivalence between the strong coupling limit of the type 2A theory and 11-dimensional supergravity is that we were able to show that the masses of the D0 brains in the type 2A theory, which go with 1 divided by the string coupling constant, can be obtained as a Kaluza-Klein compactification from the 11-dimensional theory. So what we also... what I had also mentioned is that there is the duality, so there is T-duality between type 2A and type 2B theories, so these theories are T-dual to each other. So if I take type 2A theory on a circle of radius R, it's equivalent to the type 2B theory on a circle with radius 1 over R. So 2A on a circle with radius R is equivalent to the type 2B theory on a circle with radius 1 over R. So there are T-dual in 9D, so it's a duality that holds in 9 dimensions. And so, or if you would like to add to this another circle, so what you know is that M theory, you know that type 2A theory you can get from M theory by considering a compactification on a circle. So if you take 2 circles, it means that M theory on a 2 torus is equivalent to the type 2B theory on a circle of radius 1 over R. Yes?
When you write type 2A supergravity, what's the link between type 2A supergravity and type 2A superstrings?
Okay, again, so type 2A supergravity contains just the massless fields of the string. Okay. So we come, so we, so in the weeks before, in the 2 weeks before, so we took the Welch reduction of the string and computed the spectrum on the string. And I had pointed out the calculation, how it worked for the bosonic case. So we take the Welch theory of the string and start computing the spectrum. And if you look at the massless states of the theory, say for the bosonic string, you do have the graviton, the antisymmetric tensor field, and the dilaton. So these are precisely then the fields that appear in the low energy effective action of the, yes?
Yeah, and this 11-dimensional supergravity, is it a string theory or is it just a field theory?
It's right now just a low energy effective field theory. There's no string that lives in 11 dimensions. And in fact, you are bringing me to my next important point, that in 11 dimensions, there are two types of extended objects, which are strings in 5 grains. So that's a very good point. So we construct, so we were talking about 11 dimensional supergravity. And we constructed, so we, I showed you how the action, which was in 1978, this theory was constructed. And what you have in 11 dimensions, let me show you, maybe I should write down the action. So what we do have in 11 dimensions, or let me just point out the fields that we do have in our theory. So what we do have in 11 dimensions is a metric and a four-form tensor field. And the corresponding gravitino, so let me call this psi mu. And so what we see is that there can't be a string theory that lives in 11 dimensions, because what you know is that this four-form field is the strength of the three-form potential. For the reasons that I mentioned a moment ago, this three-form potential lives on the walled volume of our membrane. So I don't have a two-index object in 11 dimensions, just a three-index object, which means in 11 dimensions I do have membranes. And then the Hodge dual to the C3 that I do have in 10 dimensions gives me a five-brain, so a five-brain, so star. So you do have the tensor fields C3 and the corresponding dual in the field. So the dual of a four-form field strength in 11 dimensions is a seven-form, which is D of a C6. So what it means is that the C6 lives on the world volume of a five-brain. Did I get this dimensions right? Let me just see. So we do have, so this is 11 D of C6, yeah, it's right. So this one, so C6 lives on the world volume of a five-brain. So that's the other extended object we have in 11 dimensions. And once we know that, we are able to derive the different types of brains we have in the type 2 theories. So what we do have is an M2 brain, which couples to the C3. And an M5 brain, which couples to the C6. In other words, I can write down a six-dimensional extended object with this C6 on the world volume. So let me see what I was going to point out next. So I can tell you what the, So what we can see, or let me finish the story with this diagram first. So I showed you, after that I showed you how the type 2B theory looks like. I had, in principle, I could have constructed type 2B supergravity starting with type 2A theory, but I didn't do that. So what I constructed the theory from scratch. And what we had seen is that type 2B theory, which is T-dual to type 2A, is invariant under S-duality. There is a relation, so that's the invariant theory. But then there are other theories that are equivalent, that are not equivalent, but transform into each other. So the S of 32 and the type 1 theory are S dual to each other. The S of 32 and the 8 cross the 8 are T dual to each other. And there is, in a similar way as you can get to the from the type 2A3 to 11-dimensional supergravity by going to the strong coupling limit, you can do the same thing for the yet plus yet hydraulic string. So what you so the strong coupling limit of the yet cross yet hydraulic string is it's called hydraulic M theory. So again, it's a strong coupling limit. And what it is hydraulic M theory is if you take M theory on a circle, you get the type 2A theory. So the statement is that M theory on a circle this way is type 2A. And if you take M theory on an interval, which means you mod out some of the fields. So let me put here, let me write down R mod Z2. It simply means modding out some of the fields, you get the hydraulic theory. So that's the way how we can connect different string theories. And again, so you realize that many of these dualities involve taking into account that the string coupling constant gets in one theory very strong, which means it's a duality that holds at the non-perturbative level. If two theories are related by S-duality, it means that when one theory is weakly coupled, so if this type 1 theory is weakly coupled, then the S-dual theory, the SO32, is strongly coupled. So, and that's also the basic message that we use when we deal with string dualities, say ADS-CFT. So when we would like to compute for a strongly coupled gauge theory, we can use a weakly coupled supergravity theory. So that's always the clue of using string dualities to your advantage. And let's see, I do have, I think, 5 minutes. 5 more minutes, so let me, yes. Well, as I said, it's just modding out some of the fields. So you have to take, it's a, where you send some of the fields to minus, so you incorporate a minus sign. It basically is just take out some of the fields that don't behave correspondingly when you switch minus signs. Yes. Oh, you had a question?
No.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Yeah, is there a way to get straight from type 1 to type 2B, or do we have to go all the way around the other way?
There's probably a way of getting. Okay, so it's a little bit, so I didn't mention, you have to take an orientiful limit, which is taking some of the fields. Again, it picks some of the fields out, because you see, type 2B is a theory that has an n equal to 2. This one has just an n equal to 1 supersymmetry. So it's a little bit more complicated, and I didn't mention it. So there's no straightforward way to put it into the discussion I'm having right now, but that's a very good point, too. Okay, so then let me go for the last thing that I wanted to mention, and I'm afraid that today I won't get to cover the real complications, but so I hope that's okay. So what we do have is, if you start, so we can, once we do have how the field content of the 11-dimensional theory looks like, so we do have a tensor field in 11 dimensions, that is a four-form field strength. So we can, from there, deduce the particle content of the, so the tensor field content of the type 2A theory. So what we know is that if you take the four-form field strength, so we compactify the 11-dimensional theory in a circle. So what we know is that if you take the four-index object, none of the indices are in the 11 direction. What we know is that we get an F4, a four-form field strength, in 10 dimensions in the type 2A theory. We can take the F with one index being the 11 index. So what we get is an H3, a three-index object in the type 2A theory. Again, so if I now look at how the dual forms look like, so we do have the forms and the dual forms, we know that in 10 dimensions, so the dual to this one is, well, it's multiplying with an epsilon symbol, which means the dual of an F4 multiplied with a 10-dimensional epsilon symbol gives me an F6, which is a D of C5. And I know that the dual of H3, the dual of H3 is a 7 form. 10 minus 3 is 7, so it's a 7 form, which is a D of C6. So what I know, and let me just tell you this. So what we know is that the field strength, so the fields that are in the Ramon sector, so what we see is that the Ramon fields of type 2A theory are field strength that are, I forgot to tell you, so there is one A1, so we do have the A1, which comes from the dimensional reduction from the matrix. So recall we had a U1 gauge field, so there is a field strength corresponding to this one, which is F2. So what I do have is in type 2A theory, I do have field strength in the Ramon sector, which are F2, F4, F6, and F6. And what I know is that this, it's a two index, so it's a C1, which couples to a string. This is a C3, which couples to a three brain. I should probably have called the other one C2. And this is a C5, which couples to a what? This one, this is not what I would like to do. This is wrong. That's not what I would like to have. Why did I say three brain? It's a two brain. So this is the DC3. So this is the DC3 that lives on the membrane. So I do have a membrane. And the F6 should couple to, let's see if it works out. So the F6 should couple to a four brain. So the F6, which is five-dimensional, so a C5 lives on a four-brain in a similar way as a C3 lives on a membrane. Yeah, we got it right. So these are the extended objects that do have Ramon charge in the type 2A theory. So what it means is I do have tensor fields C that are in the corresponding sector. So I do have an A1, an A3, or a C3, and a C5 that are fields that are in the Ramon sector. If you compute masses for this state, so what you see is that it goes with 1 divided by string coupling constant. Yes?
is there any reason why these forms, like F6 and F4 and all this, should be exact forms? That they should be D of the
And numbers? They are not. They are not.
They're not? Okay, but you
see. They are not. You have to write down. Okay, I looked how it was meant to be more symbolically. What you have to do is you have to write down the gauge invariant. So gauge invariant is always an important principle, and you have to write down the field strength that is gauge invariant. So that's the one that is going to be in your action.
And up here, you wrote M2 brain and M5 brain, C3, C6.
Yes.
Do these forms coupled to the M2 and M5 brain, or
yes,
they live
yes.
on the M2 and M5 brain?
It's the same thing. Coupling, it's the words mean the same. So coupling to a brain means just the live on the wall volume of the brain.
Okay, because I thought you meant like the brain has a charge, and that's how it couples to these forms.
It's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
So the brain is charged under this heat strength.
Okay, and the field lives on the brain.
Lives on the brain. It's the same thing. So there is a brain where you can define where the standard field lives on. And it means it has the Ramon charge because it couples to a particular tensor field that is in a particular sector.
I think this will be fun to look at in the tutorial tomorrow.
Okay, that will come in the tutorial. Okay. So what I have, that is what we have. And somebody did ask apparently the question, so what is a D string? What is an F string? So these are Ramon forms. I said that there's a string here, so there's a D string. So this is called a D string. But what we also saw is that there are other forms. Here is an H3 form, so there's a, there are also forms in the type 2A3 that live in the Lever-Schwarz sector, so in the NSNS sector. There is H3, which is a D of B2. So what we do have is there's another type of string, which is called the F string, which stands for fundamental string. It's the one that couples to the B2 that is in the Lever-Schwarz and Lever-Schwarz sector. And in general, you can have strings in the type 2B3 that are charged, so on which both lives the B2 and the F2. So in general, you can have in type 2B3 PQ strings, which means that both types of tensor fields, so the B2 and the F2, live on the world volume of the PQ string. And the last thing is if you compare this with the forms with the tensor fields that we do up in the type 2B theory. So in the type 2B theory, the fields that are in the Ramon-Ramon, the forms that are in the Ramon-Ramon sector are odd, as opposed to the type 2B theory, where they are even. So if we write down the same forms now in type 2B theory, in the Ramon-Ramon sector, so the forms that you get is a C0, which is the axiom I mentioned a moment ago. There's a C2, and there's a C4. So what I know is that this is a Hascott field stripe F1. There's an F3, an F5, which was the one that was self-dual. And I do have corresponding dual field strings. So the dual of F3 is an F7. And the dual of an F1 is an F9. So the brains that carry Ramon-Ramon charge in the type 2B theory are, so this one here, which is the, why did I mention D strings and F strings? So this is I'm not sure why I called this. This is again, so it carries Ramon-Ramon charge, so it's a D string. There is the 3 brain. There is the 7 brain. Which couples, let me see, this is the 5 brain. There's a 5 brain. There's a 7 brain. And there's a 9 brain, which fills the 10-dimensional space-time. So from there, so you can deduce always, so charged objects that are have Ramon-Ramon charge in the type 2B theory, so are all the objects that couple to odd field strength and the corresponding dual, which means that you can have strings that do have strings. You can have 3 brains, 5 brains, 7 brains, and 9 brains in type 2B theory. So that is so far the summary that I wanted to discuss. In principle, you can in a similar way as when I discussed now how particular forms in the 11-dimensional theory give you forms in the 10-dimensional theory. So you can do carefully a double-dimensional reduction of an 11-dimensional membrane where one of the legs of the membrane wraps around the circle to get the type 2A string action. Yes?
That these forms are from type 2B. So the ones that you were talking about right before were from?
Type 2A.
Type 2A, OK.
Yes?
Which is a brain, which is an N brain, and which is a D brain?
An M brain is the one that lives in 11 dimensions, M2 and M5.
What is a brain?
What is a brain?
Yes.
So I wrote down the action for the membrane, for the M2 brain.
Okay.
So that's just the generalization of a string. So you have the Green-Schwarz action for the string that Catherine wrote down. The straightforward generalization, you can write down for key brains, which are objects that have got corresponding world volume, higher dimensional world volume. So and D brains are particular type of brains that you have from Unamon charge. So where particular types of tensor fields, particular types of tensor fields, the type of B3, it's C2, C4, C0, C2, C4, and corresponding duals. So these are field strengths that come from the Ramon-Ramon sector, which means, and you can define, so that you can define this on the world volume, so you can again have world volume brains where these tensor fields live on, which means they carry, so the brains carry Ramon-Ramon charge, which are the D brains. So in a similar way as you have, so they are always non-perturbative objects. So in a similar way as you saw that the mass of the D0 brain in type 2A goes with 1 over GS, which means in the weak coupling limit, so when GS goes to 0, the mass blows up. So all of these D brains have give you effects that are of 1 divided by GS. So in the weak coupling limit, they disappear. They are objects that appear at strong coupling, which is why people didn't know about them before 1995. And that's kind of the, that's why they play such an important role in string duality at a non-perturbative level. Yes?
So in perturbative strings, like, you think that these deep brains, the surfaces, well, surfaces in space-time where the open strings connect, but, and the reason you think of them just as surfaces that are just big, sort of like walls in space-time, mm-hmm. because they're really heavy, and perturbatively really heavy, so they just look like fixed
wall. Yes.
So actually, non-perturbative, these things can actually move as well.
Yes.
Is that right?
Why don't we do one thing? So what I would like to do is to look at what Katrin discussed about D-brains, and I can go over a quick flash regarding discussions of D-brains tomorrow, and then see whether I still have time to go for Calabi-Yau manifolds. So because when I discuss now Calabi-Yau manifolds, we're going to be addressing one question that you were mentioning at the beginning of the session, which is how do we take into account different shapes and sizes in the theory of the surfaces? And that's going to play an important role, because this brings me then to my last point that I really wanted to mention on Friday, which is flux compactifications, where you can solve a problem that appears in Calabi-Yau compactifications, which is the moduli space problem. So the moduli space problem, what it means is that if you take a string theory and you compactify on a Calabi-Yau manifold, what you get is different shapes and sizes of the theory of the internal manifold are described by massless scalar fields, give you massless scalar fields in the lower dimensional action. And that's a problem because you don't see massless scalars in nature, so you need to get rid of them in some way. You need to give them a very, very heavy mass and make them disappear from your theory. And the way you can do that is by taking compactifications on a more general manifold, which are these flux compactifications. So, but that's kind of point for next time. More questions? Okay, so we answered all questions today. Okay, so let me continue then tomorrow. Let me see what I can say about D-brains and see what I can say about Calabi-Yau compactifications.